Wouldn't you want to know exactly what your users want from your website or your web application? Janice Frazier from Luxer is here to explain to us some lean user experience principles here. And Janice, just introduce yourself. What is it that you do?
Hi. Well, Luxer is it's a program for early stage companies. And basically, we help these companies use lean startup principles and user experience practices to make the best possible product and to develop really healthy product teams.
Okay, great. Now, what is it that we're going to be learning today?
So today what I chose to put into this action video is a couple of techniques organized around one of our most important principles, and that principle is goal-driven and outcome-focused product management. So we're going to look at a few really practical ways that you can make your product team more focused on the goals and have better outcomes.
Okay. As soon as they're done watching these videos, what are they going to be able to do?
Oh, they're going to be able to totally reorganize their icebox if they use Pivotal Tracker. And they'll be able to prioritize different pieces of work based on what their customers need rather than what features might seem the most sexy.
Okay, so the ability to prioritize features and what is it that people actually want.
Exactly, and really focusing on customers more than focusing on our own kind of feature and user story ideas.
Tell us more about the principle that you were talking about.
So the principle that we're working on today is that we want to be goal-driven and outcome-focused. And what that really is about is making sure that instead of just having these endless product cycles where you just work, instead what we want to be able to do is divide up our product work and our releases around accomplishing certain goals. So as a company, as a business, I know it's really important for my users to be able to, make a phone call really easily from their mobile phone.
Okay.
Right? So that could be that's a user-centered goal. You know, my customer needs this, right? That's the goal. But then the other part of that is outcome focus, which is how am I going to know whether they can do it more easily? So, you know, that's where you start getting into the testing models like A/B testing and other kinds of analytics or usability testing. So it's not enough to know what we want to accomplish on the one hand. We also have to be ready to check that we've accomplished it on the other hand. And by having these goals really defined, we can organize our releases around user goals. So this is goals almost from the point of view of the user more than even from our business point of view.
All right, so we know what we're trying to accomplish at a high level, but let's break this down. How do we define what's a good problem to even be solving? Like, let's start all the way at the bottom here and we'll work our way up.
That sounds great. So if you look at the next slide, my way of organizing this is actually to write a problem statement in a fairly formulaic way. And I learned this first from Heaton Shaw. He had this way of articulating a hypothesis. So what I'm calling a problem statement, some people are in the lean startup community are calling it a hypothesis. And here's how it goes. I actually write this out. We believe that people like this have a need to do that. Okay. If you can just imagine filling in the people like, you know, for my business, it's entrepreneurs. So people like startup founders have a need for help organizing their product backlog.
Okay.
So that's a user defined problem statement that I can then go off and start innovating solutions around. So by writing a problem statement in this way, instead of focusing on the features that I already know I think I need, what I'm doing is I'm now able to take all of that feature thinking and put it through the filter of what the customer needs. So rather than saying, well, I know what I need to build. I need to build A, B, C, D. The truth is maybe the user only needs A and B, and C and D can wait for later. I think that one of the biggest problems that entrepreneurs have is figuring out what not to do. Like, we all have way too much to do.
Right.
So we need to cut through all of that and decide what not to do. And so this is a way of really putting a good filter on that huge backlog of feature requests that's always there.
Okay. Let's apply this to another startup just to get another example here. Well, I guess they're not really so much a startup anymore, but obvious company in this situation would be Flickr to me. So you could say, we believe that people like amateur photographers have a need to share their pictures.
I would even get more focused than that. So I remember, and actually this is a real kind of story from Flickr. I was friends with some of the Flickr folks early on, and I remember having a conversation about this. One of our mutual friends had just gotten married. And so we believe that wedding guests have a need to share their wedding photos in a way that allows all the wedding photos to collect together, right? So, and you can see that a feature around that could be groups, right? So let's create a group around, you know, Mary and Joe's wedding.
Okay.
So of all the different things we could do with Flickr, we've decided to prioritize that problem statement. We want wedding guests to be able to group their photos together. And by solving that problem for that real set of people, you can see how that would extend to, you know, 1,000 other uses.
Okay. So the goal with the problem statement is to get really specific.
I think the goal with the problem statement is to be, yeah, I think really specific, because you have to solve real problems for real people, but it has to be specific around an archetype of a user. So one of the things that Lean Startup people and user experience people both think about is, who's the persona? So who are we designing this product for? And the very first thing you have to do is go talk to those people. So whether you call that customer development interviews or user research, you're still figuring out what those people need, so that then you can create these, you know, hypothetical problems that represent kind of a broad cross-section of users.
Pretend we know nothing about this. Break that down even further. Put it in dummy language.
Well, I like to be really specific, but I like to be specific around an archetype of a user rather than an individual person.
Okay.
So in the example of Flickr, it's people attending weddings, not my friend Heather.
Got it.
Right.
Perfect.
So designing around patterns that I've seen from the interviews that I've done with my customers.
Okay.
So so Lean Startup and User Experience both spend a lot of time talking to customers when you use those methods. And what we want to do is take that insight that we get from customers and translate that into relatively specific problem statements that I know will help me to have problem solution fit.
All right, so we now have a problem that's really well defined. You know, like, it's the start of the process, right? Identify a problem. Now, how do we go, how do we scale this up to having 5 or 6 problems, 10 problems that we want to solve?
Right.
How do we incorporate this into an actual workflow?
So how do we incorporate this into a workflow? So writing these problem statements is something that we do on a regular basis. Every time we know that there's something new we need to solve, we're going to choose one of these problem statements to create a release around. I'm a big fan of agile development.
Okay. So let's give us a quick snapshot of what that means.
For me, what agile means is that our software development team are working in short iterations of maybe 1 week or 2 weeks, or in some cases, there are deployments happening every day. But for the most part, a scrum or an iteration is a a short period of time with a short amount of features that we can release fairly quickly. So how do you incorporate this into a workflow?
Yeah.
So every time we want to add something to the backlog of work that needs to get done, we're going to add that in the form of a problem statement. We always want to be focusing on problem. And then once we've decided that that problem is important, we're going to move it forward and design a solution around that. And from that solution, you get the features and the user stories that go into, you know, if you use Pivotal Tracker, right, that all comes after you've made the decision to work on that particular problem. Okay?
Okay.
So all of my work comes with an assumption that we're working in an agile environment. So using Scrum or XP or one of those other kinds of agile modes.
Okay.
And to me, what that means is that we're working towards short increments of release rather than really long, you know, couple of months before you release any code kind of environments.
Right. Get stuff out there quick and see how it actually performs.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. So to scale this up, you've got this backlog of problems. And what I have found, if you look at the next slide, I have found that it can be really helpful to go into your icebox or parking lot or whatever you call that really long list of things that you know you need to do, but they never get done, and really pull that apart. So I've been calling this Icebox Zero. Icebox is the term that you'll see in a really popular tool called Pivotal Tracker, which is how a lot of Agile teams organize their work. And the icebox is just that place where stories go to die. Because, you know, like, if it's not done in a couple of months, it's just never going to get done sort of thing. And then everybody feels really guilty because they're, you know, their icebox is like, you know, 1,000 lines of stuff that they're never going to do. So it can be really important, though, to keep those ideas alive. So some of those ideas are going to be really important, and we need a way to address it all without having to live with that big fat icebox. So here's what I do. What we want to do is go through the icebox and write a problem card the way that we just talked about to summarize any of the work that's indicated in that icebox.
Okay.
So
and that would be the "we believe that people like..."
Yeah.
That's something. Okay.
So what appears in the icebox is more like a user story, like add Ajax to this page kind of thing. And what we want to do is take all of that line level to-do list stuff and associate it with a user problem that matters. Okay? So what we're going to do is go through the whole icebox, write problem cards for that. And I had one team try this a couple months ago, 2 months ago. I think it took them about 3 hours to empty their whole icebox. And this is a company that had been around for a year and a half.
Okay.
So, you know, just to give you a sense of scale. Then they threw away every story. They deleted every story in their icebox, which made them feel refreshed and new, like a shower on a spring day. Then they took all of those cards that they had written. They had written all their problem statements on 3x5 cards, and they taped them on a wall, like literally just on the wall, which is something that we do a lot in Agile. Incidentally, we also do that a lot in user experience, is use the walls as a way to organize things. So, and then anytime they have capacity to take on another piece, they go to the wall and they prioritize, they choose the user problem that is most important to solve. So instead of saying, this week we're going to build the registration system and next week we're going to build the dashboard widget and the following week we're going to do something else, what we're trying to do is focus on solving the right problem for our customers. So all those problem cards are customer-oriented statements. So I can say, the customer needs to be able to da-da-da-da-da, see their progress. Okay, the customer has to be able to see their progress, so let's build them a dashboard.
Okay.
Right? So that way we can come up with better ideas about solving that problem rather than just building the first thing that pops up in our mind. Hey, it would be good to have, you know, a dashboard.
Okay, so this is really just a way of thinking, like translating problems into real world problems, like things that your customers are actually bumping up against.
So it's, I think that it's super easy for all of us, whether we're developers, designers, product managers, what have you. It's the easiest thing for all of us is to come up with the solution first. And if there's one thing I know from 15 years working in design, it's that our first idea is sometimes the best idea, but sometimes it's not. So what we need to be doing is always finding a way to think better. Well, we always want to be finding a way to think better about what we ought to build.
Okay.
So that's why if we focus on solving a customer problem as our unit of work, then we're not presuming that we know the solution until we really dig into that problem.
Got it.
There are always five or six different ways we could solve the problem.
Okay.
That makes sense?
Yeah, yeah, that does. So are you seeing increased efficiency when you're working this way?
Yeah. It makes it a lot easier to talk about what you ought to do. So there's always more to do than any of us have capacity for. At least, you know, you put five smart people in a room and they can come up with a year's worth of work in 10 minutes, you know, just brainstorming.
Right.
That's just the nature of it.
Okay.
So what this allows us to do is prioritize our effort based on what we understand our customer needs most.
Okay.
And that's really the thing, is we want to be focusing not on what looks sexiest or what our investor wants us to build, but what is going to get us to product market fit soonest.
Okay. Now, how many items can you hold in this on your wall concurrently?
That's part of it, is that it doesn't matter how many ideas you have or how many problems you observe. You can have five in a stack, or you can have 40, and I've seen both happen. And what matters is that you know enough about your customer to be able to choose the right one to solve first.
Okay, so how do we stop, say, a wall of 40 items to stop to be our new icebox, you know, like our icebox 2.0?
Yeah, how do you keep it from getting stale?
Right, I mean, like,
yeah.
It seems like if you let it build up so much, you'd just be trading one problem for another.
That's a really good question. And the difference is in the order of magnitude, or I guess you could say the granularity. So when it's in the icebox, in your tracker, or whatever management software you're using.
Some people might just have a list of things to do in a Word document.
Yeah, yeah. But when it's at that level, it's always... it's always at the order of magnitude where it's like, build this thing or add this to a page. So you can't put it into a priority list and choose what to do next on any kind of equal basis. So they can be like, you know, make a registration system or add Ajax to that page. So you're kind of balancing in equal things, and when you in the backlog or in the icebox, you're going to get a long, long, long list of items that could all summarize into one or two problem statements. So on the wall with the problem statements, what you're going to get is a smaller inventory of things to compare, and
okay.
They're all the same kind of thing.
Okay.
So it's a lot easier to compare A to B, and you'll have a smaller number to work with.
Okay.
And sometimes, you know, the more you talk to your customers, the more you're going to know exactly what it is that they need. So you'll be able to say, oh, yeah, we found out, you know, here's one. We're going to rip that off and tear it up because it's not necessary anymore. We learned that.
Okay. So it sounds like the point of putting it up on the board and in converting it to these sort of statements, you can just deal with things quicker. Like you can actually see what's important and what's not.
Yeah, you can see what's important and what's not. Your priority conversations are shorter. Not, I think that having more confidence in what you choose to work on is super high value.
Now, the next step is write the design test. What does this mean?
Yeah, so for that one, I'd like to move on to the next slide. the writing the design test is an idea that, again, I really, I'm a designer, but I love Agile, and I love a lot of what Agile, a lot of the reliability that Agile practice has brought to software development. And one of the patterns that I've seen in Agile is this idea of test-driven development. And what that means is that the software developers, they actually write the test that will prove that their software is functioning correctly before they write the software.
Hmm.
So you write the test, and by writing the tests, you're figuring out kind of a lot of the nuances of the code. And then when you write the code, it fails all your tests until the moment that it passes all your tests, and then you know you're done, right? So that's the idea of test-driven development. And what that's allowed is for a lot more reliability and the quality of the code to go up.
Okay.
I want to do the same for design. And I think it is at least possible in concept. And I believe that going through the exercise of writing the test first for design is helping us to focus more crisply on solving customer needs rather than, you know, entertaining ourselves through our own creative genius, right? So a design test would take that problem statement. So I believe that people like this have a problem doing that. And then I match that with, we will know that we have succeeded when we can see this quantitative outcome, a measurable outcome, okay, or a qualitative observable outcome. And we know that those outcomes contribute to some key performance indicator of our success as a company.
Okay. All right.
So,
fill in these blanks for us. Give us some real world examples.
Sure. A quantitative outcome. So the easiest way to explain quantitative outcomes is through A/B testing, for instance.
Okay.
I'm working with a company right now to improve their search results interface. And we will know that we have succeeded when the A/B test shows that the new version has higher conversion than the old version.
Okay.
And higher conversion really is straightforward. It's more people click on the buy now button, basically.
Okay.
And we can evaluate that using analytics software.
Okay. Now, so this is just a formula. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people are doing this already, aren't they?
Yep.
When they're evaluating things. So this is just a specific formula, or like what's different about this than what people are already doing?
What's different about this is that some people are sometimes doing some measurement, but they're not necessarily thinking about the measurement before they design the solution.
Okay.
So that's a huge change.
Okay.
And what I'm saying is, if I know that what I want to do is increase signups, or if what I want to do is make it easier to use, then I can focus my creative thinking around what might actually create that outcome.
Okay. All right, so you'd say plan this from the start. Like that's one of the biggest changes.
Yeah, so what I would say is, like, instead of saying I want to redesign the homepage, I might say I want to increase I want to state it like this. Instead of saying I'm going to redesign the homepage, what I'm going to say instead is I believe that our customers have a problem understanding what our site is about. I will know that I have succeeded with my new design when 5-second test demonstrates understanding 25% more.
Okay.
Okay. So 5-second test is a particular, you know, .com testing service, and I have, you know, with that kind of statement, I'm saying I've done a benchmark, say 20% of people understand what my site does, and I want to increase that to 25%, right?
Okay.
Once I know that, then it's not just redesign the homepage. It's I want to get this outcome. So
exactly.
I can work on 5 or 6 different versions of messaging that will help me to get to that outcome.
Okay. So you're identifying the exact things you want to do before you before you even start. So it's removing a lot of the ambiguity.
Right. So that we know why we're designing a solution, so that we can then know whether our designs are effective or not. So the next blank there that we want to fill in is the qualitative / observable outcomes. So the Lean Startup folks are very keen on quantitative, on metrics and analytics, but we need to remember also that straight up usability can be an outcome. So sometimes the goal that we want to address is not something that we can measure. Sometimes it's something we have to see for ourselves.
Like what?
Well, so usability is the classic example. And if somebody has a hard time going through a set of interfaces, we can design around that, but only if we see why they're having problems. So our quantitative analytics can point us to problems, but then we will have to watch people use it to know why they're having problems. So again, using the easy example of registration, I can know that I'm getting drop-off at the third step of my registration, but I don't know why unless I watch someone do it.
Okay.
Right? But once I watch two or three people do it and they're all getting stuck on a certain thing, I can go, oh, yeah, okay. And then I can solve that problem.
Okay. All right. So the next thing that we have is a KPI.
KPI stands for Key Performance Indicator. And it's one of the key performance indicators is that set of, that small set of metrics that determine whether your company is doing well or not. So the startup metrics for pirates is acquisition, activation, referral, revenue, and retention. And those are most likely some form of KPI for your company. And sometimes the design work that we're doing isn't exactly or directly going to hit one of those KPIs, but we know that it's related. So we just want to be really conscious about what it is that we're doing and why we're doing it and why it matters.
Now, let's apply this to something that we all know, Flickr again. We'll keep using that as our example.
Okay, so with the weddings example on Flickr, what you might have are quantitative outcomes like people inviting their friends to participate in a group or number of people setting up a group. And a qualitative outcome would really have to be around how easy it is to do that. And the KPI that that would connect with would be sort of total usage, so number of registered members, for instance. So this would be a referral, let's say, KPI. So does that help?
Yeah, that does.
Okay.
Okay, so is there anything else that we need to know about writing these design tests?
So I do like to get fairly specific with these design tests, but when you're getting started doing it, it's like any other skill. It feels really awkward at first, but you get better as you try it again and again and again. And if this becomes habit, it gets really easy to just think this way. So it'll feel weird at first, but it gets easier. So all of this, the wireframe check is kind of like a bonus idea, because what we've got so far is this bookend of like, we're going to organize all of our work according to user problems. So we know that we're going to have problem solution fit, right? So that's part one of customer development is problem solution fit. And on the other end, we're measuring the outcomes. So we'll know if our experiments have been successful, which is classic lean startup, right? So we know that we're working within the right framework. But then inside of that, we have to always make sure that we're only working on the stuff that really matters, that we're not wasting our effort. I mean, Eric Ries says, stop wasting my time, stop wasting your time, right? And this is, the wireframe check is one of the best ways to stop wasting time. If I have only 5 seconds to teach somebody something, it's this. So here's what you do. If you're designing a page and you've made a sketch, I don't care whether it's on a whiteboard and you've taken a photo of it or a pencil sketch on a piece of paper or you've like done some huge thing in OmniGraffle and like laid it all out with a beautiful explanation, everything. When you finish a wireframe, you have a stand-up meeting with a developer. And in that stand-up meeting, you ask four questions. One, is this wireframe an accurate reflection of the system? Often the answer is no, and that is often a good thing. It's fine, and you have that conversation. What you don't want is for the designer to have accidentally designed something that doesn't match the way the system really works. And I've done this. Every designer has done this. So having that conversation is really important, because if you've misunderstood how the system works, you're speccing a lot more work for the developer.
Right.
So is this an accurate reflection of the system is one. Two is what here is hard, because designers often just don't realize that the things that they're asking for are hard. You know, maybe that's because of how the data model works or whatever, but we think it's really easy to move from a thing from this side of the page to that side of the page, but it turns out that it's really, really difficult and it'll take a day. Like, I could never have anticipated that. So after, is this an accurate reflection of the system? What here is hard? Then what alternatives are there? Like, is there some other way? And the developer and the designer together can come up with other approaches that might be easier. Then after you've done that exploration, you can say, is it worth the effort? So, you know, I think this whole conversation takes place over less than 5 minutes.
Okay.
It's a stand-up conversation. Maybe it will inspire a longer, more in-depth conversation, but only if it's worth it, right? And what we want to avoid here is a situation that I've seen happen way too many times, where a designer puts together a page and they hand it off to the developer. And the developer, with all good intentions, wanting to be a good team player, says, oh crap, this is going to be really difficult. And they go off and they spend 2 days busting their ass to deliver what the designer specified. And they come back and they're like, oh man, it was really hard, but I did it, and here you go, and like, isn't it beautiful? And the designer goes, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't know that was going to be hard. And then everybody's like, ah! You know, so you have these two people who are trying to do their best work and be good team players, like really pissing each other off. And this quick wireframe check will do away with that 90%. So that's what the wireframe check is for. Like, let's just make sure that we're spending our time on the things that really deserve it.
Okay. Now, it seems like that would that'd be good practice for a startup that has a designer and a coder. But what if it's just like a one person team or a two person team? I guess you're not much of a team if it's just one person.
Yeah. But this is really best for teams. It doesn't matter whether it's a designer or not. I say designer only when I mean whoever's creating the spec that the developer is going to be developing off of. So in most of my clients, that's not a designer. It's somebody acting in a design capacity. So it doesn't matter if it's the product manager or the CEO or the business person or whatever.
Right.
Whoever's making that wireframe should check in with the developer and ask those four questions before the developer starts coding.
Okay.
So
here, let me set up a scenario here. Let's say there's a business guy and a developer. Like, that's the startup.
Right.
And would it make sense for the engineer to do this, to create the wireframe and then code it?
No. Usually it's a case, this would apply to a case where the business guy was making wireframes. So the coder's just going to start coding. I mean, if you can code, you're just going to start building pages. Maybe you'll sketch them on a pad of paper first. But a developer is at less risk of asking for more work than is necessary. Like, the coder's going to be able to sort of, hopefully, if they're any good, they'll be able to sort of, in their head, figure out the easiest way to accomplish something. That's just how a developer's going to think.
Right.
So this is for people who aren't developers, who don't know how the system really works from a back-end point of view, and who need to communicate efficiently and effectively with the developer to have a conversation about how much work they're asking for.
Got it.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. is there anything else that we need to know about, like, just this whole process? So we've learned how to first identify a problem, how to organize it, and how to use these wireframes to make sure that we're not just wasting time. Like, is there anything else that we need to know?
Oh, well, there's a thousand things we all need to know, but you can't know everything. I would say about this, it's the thing that we need to keep in mind is that what we're all looking for is product market fit. What we want is to make a piece of software that solves a real problem for real people who are probably not a lot like us. Even if it started out and we were our target audience, as soon as you start building the software, then you're kind of less objective. So the more time we can spend with real customers or prospects, the better able we are to decide which problems are most important to solve. So the thing to keep in mind here is that everything goes back to real customers and talking to them and getting to know them as well as you can.
Janice, thanks a ton for your time. And thanks for showing us how to use this method to just make our businesses more efficient. I can think of so many different times when this would be helpful for me. Just going back and forth with the developer specifically, like this is just going to save me a ton of time.
Great. I'm so happy to help.
All right. Hey, thanks again, and we'll see you again soon.
All right. Bye-bye.